Hello and welcome to The Wire, your independent national coverage of current affairs right across Australia on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Amina Shakir coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. And today on the show...
It's really trying to appease the pressure from the public who are feeling quite unsafe and scared and fearful for good reasons.
New concerns over proposals sentencing 14-year-olds as adults in Victoria.
When millions of people engage with content that excuses abuse or shames Black women for having boundaries or, shapes real attitudes and behaviours that we see.
New study reveals the digital abuse and control is harming Black women online. And later today...
And many people say that the symptoms of menopause and the lack of support that they're getting to make them better are resulting in a reduced confidence in the workplace and lower self-esteem.
Menopause continues to impact working women significantly. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. The Victorian government's proposed adult time for violent crime could mean children as young as 14 who commit severe crimes would face sentencing as adults. Under the proposal, judges would be expected to consider community safety over age. The new proposal has been criticised by experts as punitive and short-sighted, saying real long-term solutions should be prioritised. The Wire's Sam Giorgio spoke with Dr. Marietta Martinovic, Associate Professor in Criminology and Justice at RMIT University, to hear her reaction.
I've spoken a lot about this over the last 24 hours. One thing that I can summarise it as is short-sighted. And what I mean by that, it's really trying to appease the pressure from the public who are feeling quite unsafe and scared and fearful for good reasons.
What other methods should be considered rather than potentially putting children in prison for up to 20 years?
So decades and decades of research in Australia and around the Western world all show the same thing. And they all show that punishment of young people in particular just does not work. And what works is prevention in the first place and early intervention, diversion. So I think what we must talk about and mustn't forget to talk about is there are these common threads that kids who get trouble in the law all have. And they're all connected with poverty, homelessness, violence and abuse, health and mental health issues, disabilities, learning problems, dropping out of school, and for many First Nations peoples and migrant families, it's also systemic racism and intergenerational trauma. So we're talking about people who have disadvantages from birth. And to then put these people in prison instead of to actually deal with some of basic human needs, such as providing a safe home, food, clothes, healthcare, school, support, we are doing completely the opposite and further failing these people.
Queensland and a few other states have implemented a very similar law and have reported lower crime rates. Does this mean it's been effective, or, like you said before, is this a short-term strategy that praises incarceration over any sort of rehabilitation or prevention?
Look, in the short term, it's quite possible that the crime rates drop, and that's what seems to have happened in Queensland. But I absolutely am worried about what's to come, number one. And number two, what kind of young people are going to we be producing as a society? I think when you see and hear of these horrific offences, I think we should all ask ourselves, how did these people get to this point? And what services have intervened or not intervened and dealt with these issues much earlier on?
How do we mitigate the actual drivers of crime while also committing to serving community safety?
I think it's a balance. Like I said, it would be stupid to say, well, everything's working beautifully at the moment in terms of laws and services that we provide. Well, it isn't, because we can see that there is a surge in crime. We can see that, like I said before, there's real actual fear that people are feeling out there, and governments have to act or be responsive to that. And I completely understand that. But then at the same time, what I'm feeling is there needs to be some kind of a redesign of the services that are available to help vulnerable children and their families so that they can find a way forward. So there are programs that work, and they all seem to be culturally specific. They all seem to be trauma-informed. They all seem to be long-term solutions. And it's really about that early intervention and finding what works. Peer mentoring seems to be a really good way forward for young people in Victoria, at least, and be providing really good results. So I think it's about really looking outside of that punitive retribution-based urge and really thinking about what actually works and investing our money and resources there. I have not come across anybody who said over the last 24 hours or so, wow, this is excellent, except for the police association. And I do think the police are dealing with the brunt of the situation. So I don't think they have an easy job at all. In fact, they have a very difficult job. And they also need more resources and support. So I think they also have the long end of the stick in this situation.
That was Dr. Marietta Martonovic from RMIT University speaking to the YSM Giorgio. New research from Charles Darwin University has revealed how social media influencers use manipulation and cultural pressure to police Black women's behavior online. The study shows that harmful messages discouraging independence and punishing women who express autonomy are widely amplified by algorithms. I spoke with researcher Vimbai Muturo about the harm of these messages.
Well, it's an urgent issue because it all revolves around, you know, gender-based violence, right? We've seen that this is an ongoing endemic, and Black women are disproportionately victims of gender-based violence. And what happens online no longer stays online. When millions of people engage with content that excuses abuse or shames Black women for having boundaries, or shapes real attitudes and behaviors that we see offline. And as I said, Black women already face disproportionate rates of gender-based violence, and these digital messages normalize those harms. And young people also see this type of content, and they start to believe that what they see online is how they should treat relationships, how they should treat Black girls and Black women offline. So the impact is very cultural and emotional and also life-threatening.
What were some of the main harmful messages you found in, I guess, the videos you analyzed?
Well, after analyzing 80 short-form videos and really going in depth at about 28 of them, there were four main themes. The overarching theme was policing Black women's femininity, or what it means to be a Black woman. But there was also the devaluing of independence by promoting fear of being single, and weaponizing racial and cultural identity, which really put Black women in this weird space where you have to choose your Blackhood over your womanhood. You have to choose, you know, being a sellout to your race or standing up for, you know, gender equality, which was very kind of really manipulative. And I found that really, like, I don't know how to explain, but that whole thing where they say, you know, feminism is a Western import, and as a Black woman, you should stay away from that. The feminism has no space for Black women and Black communities, and it's so toxic. And also the framing of abuse in relationship as Black feminine duty, like a Black woman is just supposed to endure harm, and that gives us strength. So those were the things that really stood out that were just egregious.
You just described how Black women, I guess, are forced to choose between Blackness or their womanhood. Mm-hmm. How does this pressure show up across, I guess, different platforms you analyzed?
Well, there's a lot of talk in, I guess, people who like to call themselves gurus and who claim to be very pro-Black, but their messages always have this this theme of how Black women should behave if they also want to be pro-Black. And that behavior means no matter what harm you receive, if it's from a Black man or a Black boy, don't seek help from the white man. You know, don't seek help from authority. So then we end up seeing a lot of underreporting offline, or the fact that that whole dialogue on that gender equality is against Black family norms, is against Black identity to want to be viewed as equal, to, you know, everything from being having sexual desires, for example, shouldn't be something that is associated to being Black or African. You know, there's no desire that a Black woman should have other than reproducing children and being of servitude. And so deviating from that, you get called, you know, you're trying to be white, you're a coconut. For those who don't know what coconut is, Black on the outside, white on the inside, or you're a traitor to your race because Black women should fit in this box. So that's where that whole, you know, oh, if I want my own autonomy, or if I don't want to follow this box that I've been put into, am I no longer Black enough? Am I being a traitor of my own identity as a Black person? I don't think it should be separated. And I feel like when it is separated, it causes that that weird space where you don't know how to identify. And I feel like what we should be promoting is that Black women are whatever Black women want to be. You know, I don't have to choose between being Black or being a woman. I am a Black woman. And as a Black woman, I should be treated as an equal to Black men, as an equal to white men, as an equal to white women, as an equal to Asian women. That it shouldn't be separated. Because we don't see other races having to deal with that. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't see other races having to separate that. So we should just be taken at value that we've got the autonomy to be whatever form of womanhood, whatever form of femininity you define yourself to be.
How do social media algorithms help spread these negative and harmful ideas or videos that we see?
For content, rage bait is the best thing that a lot of content creators produce to get the views, to get the clicks, to get the money. So saying outrageous stuff is nothing new. We see that because it has engagement. But the difference here is what's found in the comment sections. So when we see a lot of rage bait videos that are targeted to other races of women, you see a lot of outrage in the comments. That's great. We want people to see that this is a nonsense video. This is nonsense advice. But with the videos I analyzed that were targeted to Black women, the comment sections were praising a lot of this this rhetoric. We're saying, yeah, that's the sexist thing that you just said is exactly right. Or, yeah, you shouldn't leave your relationship just because you got slapped a few times. It's so hard to go through the comments and find people who are saying, this is madness. This is not safe for Black women. It is always in support of that. So it's the engagement. So the algorithms will always push things that have rage bait because that's what people click on. That's what people share. But it's how people accept this information and how people end up, you know, having that dialogue in the comment section.
Do you see examples of, I guess, creators pushing back against this policing and, you know, what impact did that have?
One of the positive things that I found while doing this research is that there are a lot of content creators who have been, you know, reposting these videos and having their own commentary on how harmful this is. And there's a lot of Black content creators, Black women content creators, and Black men who are speaking out against this. So, you know, things are changing, but their views don't match the same views as the outrageous, harmful videos that are out there. This is something that is very close to my heart because I am a Black woman. I love being a Black woman, but I have seen these social issues come in my own life, both digitally and offline. And I just hope that my work can help just spread the message that Black women deserve the freedom to define their own femininity on their own terms, not through fear, shame, or old tropes that glorify subordination, that glorify suffering. So that's what I'm hoping to do with my research. And thank you so much.
That was researcher Vimai Maturo speaking to The Wire. You're listening to The Wire on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Amina Shakir in Melbourne. A big hello to our listeners in Alice Springs on 8CCC 102.1 FM. To our friends in Noosa on Noosa FM 101.3. And to the other side of the country to Radio Goolari in Broome, Western Australia. According to the Government of South Australia Office for Women, women experiencing menopause are the fastest growing working demographic, up nearly 40% since 1980. It is estimated the menopause costs women between $17 and $35 billion annually in lost earnings and superannuation. Many organisations in Australia have received the menopause-friendly accreditation, an organisation that aims to support menopause at work. The Wire's Roche V spoke to founder and CEO of Menopause Friendly Australia, Grace Molly, about this work.
Well, menopause is a normal transition that anyone born with ovaries will experience. Many people don't understand what the symptoms are, and many people say they can't leave those symptoms at the door when they go into work. So research shows actually the top five symptoms of menopause that impact people in the workplace are fatigue, hot flushes, focus and concentration issues, anxiety and worry, and insomnia. And if you think about those symptoms, we're bringing those with us into the workplace. So they do have an impact on how we are experiencing the workplace. And we did some research last year with Dove, and we interviewed over 1,000 working women. And the results were really shocking. We actually revealed that 45% of people felt that they weren't performing their best at work due to menopause symptoms. And many people say that the symptoms of menopause and the lack of support that they're getting to make them better are resulting in a reduced confidence in the workplace and lower self-esteem. And again, that piece of research showed 46% of people who are experiencing symptoms felt that their confidence was reduced as a result of those symptoms, and 44% said that they had lower self-esteem. So this really does have an impact on not only those people who are experiencing menopause, but also on our workplaces and the people around them within those workplaces.
How can workplaces better accommodate menopausal women in the workforce?
The number one thing workplaces can do is to provide awareness, provide training on what menopause is, how it impacts people, not just for those experiencing it, but for everyone, because it really is a topic that everyone should know about. But also then a workplace needs to put in place some guidance or a policy, again, so that people within the organisation know what support is available, what reasonable adjustments they might be able to request. And that might be something as simple as a desk fan to help with hot flushes, saying, what can we do to help? What would be how can we make our working environment better for you? And again, it's really about looking at the core principle of culture. So breaking down any stigma or taboo associated with this topic so that people feel that it is a comfortable conversation that's welcome within the workplace, and it's not something that they have to hide or fear having a conversation about.
What is the aim of Menopause Friendly Australia?
So Menopause Friendly Australia is really on a mission to give menopause information to people where they are. And 81% of us will be working through our menopause transition. So we really want every employer, from a small business through to a big ASX 10 organisation, to be able to open the conversation, to have some support available for people, and to really normalise what can be a confusing time of life.
What are the best management plans for menopause in the workplace?
So there's five pillars of being a menopause-friendly workplace, and these are based on evidence. So the menopause-friendly standards help organisations to have that structure so that they can feel confident when they're bringing an initiative into their workplace that that initiative is going to be successful. So those pillars are training. Again, I mentioned earlier, it's so important that we provide training on menopause because most people don't even know what menopause is, the ages, stages, signs and facts and figures. So giving that really appropriate information communication in the workplace is the first step, so training people. The second thing is communications and engagement. So we need to be talking about menopause. We need to make it a normal conversation and have those opportunities to celebrate also how amazing people are in midlife. Having a policy or a guidance on menopause is vital. Now, looking at culture, so culture is obviously something that unwritten rules of engagement in a workplace, and an improved culture comes from normalising and destigmatising this conversation. Again, making it not an extraordinary thing to talk about in the workplace. So having that workplace culture that's really strong. And lastly, probably the easiest one to think about is your facility. So looking at your working environment. Both five pillars of menopause-friendly accreditation really provide that confidence to employers when they're wanting to bring an initiative in, that it's going to be successful and that it will ensure that their organisation is sustainably menopause-friendly.
Is there anything else you would like to add?
Yeah, I just want to encourage any employers out there who are thinking about becoming a menopause-friendly workplace. The number one piece of feedback we get from our organisations who are now accredited is just get on and do it. I wish I had done it earlier. It's been a really great, exciting initiative that people have really got behind. And lastly, there's an international standard, an ISO standard, on menopause and menstrual health, which is being developed.
Grace Molly from Menopause Friendly Australia speaking with The Wire's Rosh V. New national polling shows strong public demand for climate safeguards in Australia's environmental laws, with most voters wanting climate impact considered before approving new coal and gas projects. The data suggests Labor could lose nearly half its support if it leaves climate out of its reforms, as Australians expect laws that protect communities and nature from worsening climate harm. I spoke with YouGov Director of Public Affairs and Public Data, Paul Smith, about the climate change needs of Australians.
Australians want climate change addressed in our new environmental laws. And it's very clear that an overwhelming number of Australians want that addressed in the new environmental laws, according to our poll.
What climate safeguards do you think must be added to the laws for new coal and gas projects?
Well, Australians overwhelmingly think that climate change should be addressed in assessing any public application for that type of proposal.
How serious is the risk for Labor if it leaves climate out of its reforms?
There is a very serious risk for Labor that if it doesn't address climate change, up to 44% of its voters in the last election have said that they would be less likely to vote for Labor. Now, this is a very serious, a large number. It doesn't mean they'll all stop voting Labor immediately. But when 44% of your voters take something so seriously, they'll say, I'm much less likely to vote for you now. That puts a huge risk in the long-term future of the government. And I think there's a great risk that many of those voters would be disappointed if a deal was done with the opposition, who have now required a brand image of being anti-climate change, that would, if it was felt that deal didn't address climate change sufficiently in the new proposed legislation.
Would ignoring climate in the laws hurt Australia's credibility as like it prepares for the COP31?
Well, I think the really important issue is whether how it affects the government's credibility on this issue. We have a situation where Australians now see being serious on climate change as part of the sort of requirements for government. It's a threshold issue, just in the same way as people expect the government to be good on managing the economy, on looking after people's security. They also want to be serious about dealing with the effects of climate change, because Australians see climate change as a fact. And Australians overwhelmingly say they're not prepared to vote for a government. 52% of Australians say they're not prepared to vote for a government or even consider voting for them unless they think they're serious about climate change. And that creates a problem because the coalition is now seen as not serious on this issue. And a deal with them puts at risk the government's own credibility on this issue if it's seen the outcome is not one that addresses climate change.
That was Paul Smith, YouGov Director, speaking to The Wire. And unfortunately, that is the end of today's show. Thanks so much for listening wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER in Sydney, Radio Adelaide 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Brisbane, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and Community Radio Network. Check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, X and LinkedIn. The Wire acknowledges the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of Kulin Nations, the traditional custodians of the lands where the program is produced. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. I'm Amina Shakur, coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.